Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, and welcome to Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. I'm your host, retired NYPD Sergeant Bill Cannon, a 27-year veteran of the NYPD, bringing you Police Off the Cuff. You know, when we look into the Kansas Moms case, as I've been calling it, and we look into these four defendants here, an interesting thing, of course, would be what defenses might these suspects raise in this case? And you see the upper left-hand corner of this little thumbnail, and you have the motive and the overt acts and the premeditation. Those things make it so much more difficult for a defense attorney to defend a client. But we also notice when we look at this thumbnail, there are four defendants, aren't there? So one of the things I think we all have to ask, who is the weakest one? Who is the person that has the least culpability in regards to the motive and the overt acts and the premeditation? Well, perhaps Cora Twombly. Perhaps. I don't know who the prosecution is looking toward to potentially cut a deal with, if anyone. Will they be looking to cut a deal with anyone? That's a favorite prosecutorial tactic, because you can get an inside view into what actually occurred from one of the defendants. And there's a possibility that Cora Twombly could be the weakest link here. There she is on the screen with her husband, Cole Earl Twombly. And that's the question I ask. Who is the weakest link? And could she be, in fact, the weakest link here? Undoubtedly, the person that would absolutely get no play whatsoever would be Tiffany Adams, the one you see on the screen here, because she is, if you want to call her the mastermind, she is the one behind this whole thing. She's the planner. She's the one with the most in this game. She's the one that had a custody battle going back over 5 years. And then we look at Cole Twombly. I just don't see him as being the person, the sympathetic character to a jury that a prosecutor would cut a deal with. And of course, he's done some overt acts that we can look at some of the court documents in this case and see what his overt acts were. And then we, of course, have Tad Cullum. Apparently, he's the significant other of Tiffany Adams. And that was his leased land that they buried the bodies on. So I don't see him as being the sympathetic character that a prosecutor would cut a deal with. So that, of course, leaves Cora Twombly. We're going back right to the beginning. Cora Twombly being the person that might be the most sympathetic in regards to a prosecutor cutting a deal. Well, what kind of deal would she be cut? That remains to be seen. How much time? How much planning did she do in this case? What was her overt acts? What was her premeditation? All of those things will come into play if and when the prosecutor decides to cut a deal. And there's a possibility that the prosecutor may not go that way. There may be enough against all four of these defendants, Tad Cullum, Tiffany Adams, Cole Twombly, and Cora Twombly, to go against all four of them, to charge all four of them. This is a death penalty case. Let's charge all four of them and go forward. So folks, hang on to your seats, hang on to your hats. You're about to enter true crime from a police perspective. You're about to enter the off-the-cuff zone, the police off-the-cuff zone.
Give me some common sense.
Yes, sir. They have the car stopped at 10th and Grant, Michael Byder.
We still don't know who pulled the trigger.
We are back. You know, one of the things that we're going to get into too is, of course, the alleged, well, more than alleged, the confession that Tiffany Adams made. And the defense attorneys love to make light of this, but I'm going to put the document right up on the screen. There you go. Proof of guilt is evident. See attached sworn affidavit detailing the relevant facts at this time. The state would point out that after arrest, this defendant, Tiffany Adams, did provide a recorded statement to law enforcement indicating her responsibility for the death of the deceased. What does that mean, though? What was the recorded statement? Already the defense attorneys or the talking heads that the defense attorneys are saying, oh, you know, confessions can be coerced. Confessions can be forced. Confessions don't mean everything. If a confession is taken correctly, a confession means everything. A confession can be one of the most powerful pieces of evidence that a prosecutor could have. But what do I mean be taken correctly? First of all, when they say this was an in-custody confession or statement, whatever language they're using, means that Miranda applied. What do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is the person is under arrest and the person was in custody. Therefore, Miranda would have to be read and waived for a legal, voluntary, intelligent, and knowing confession to be taken. I would think that the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation have investigators that, of course, know how to do this. They did such a good job. In all other aspects of this case, how could they screw up taking of the confession? So what does it mean to take a confession? Well, when a good investigator goes into a room with a defendant, one of the early things he's going to do, and some police departments require Miranda to be read immediately before questioning proceeds. So they successfully read Miranda. They successfully obtain a waiver. Now they start talking. And there's a Yiddish word that people love to use in New York. It's called schmooze. You try to get the defendant to like you, the interviewer, the interrogator, the detective. You schmooze them. You get them to feel like you're a regular guy. You're a good guy. You have their best interest in mind. And then you start questioning them. And this is all on, should be on videotape. Because when it's on videotape, it can be demonstrated that there was no coercion. No one was being forced. And there was no ill treatment of the defendant. And it's always a good idea during these interviews to offer to the defendant breaks to go to the bathroom. Would you like to go to use the bathroom right now? And of course, you document that. Would you like a glass of water? Would you like some water? Would you like anything? Would you like something to eat? We could take a break. Do you want something to eat? Because when you successfully obtain this confession, and this person at some point winds up in court, how is the defense attorney going to attack this confession? Well, I'll tell you how. They're going to attack it by saying the detective abused the defendant. He didn't offer her bathroom breaks. He didn't offer her anything to eat. She was there for 8 hours. He didn't offer her a time to take a break. He didn't offer her to make phone calls. That would be done after the statements were taken. So all of these things a really good investigator knows he should say. At 0900 hours, I offered, in this case, Tiffany Adams a chance to use the bathroom. She said she had to go to the bathroom. I got a female detective to escort her to the bathroom. She left at 0900. She came back at 0910 hours. At that point, I asked her, would she like a drink of water? She said, yes, she would like a water. I got her a bottle of water, which she drank during the interview. Would you like something to eat? Not right now. I'm not hungry. Okay. All of that needs to be documented, because months later from now, a defense attorney is going to try to make the detective look like a subhuman, that you did not offer my client a chance to use the bathroom. She was not offered water. She was there for 6 hours. But an experienced investigator, a good interviewer, a good interrogator will document all of these things. And then when it's on videotape, as it should be, and I can't swear to that fact if it was on videotape right now, because that's not indicated, that will show that the person being interviewed was not abused. So brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Now, what does the investigator, what type of information does the interviewer want to get out of the defendant? In this case, he wants to talk a little bit about the custody battle that Tiffany had with Sharon Butler. Why? Well, because that provides motive, doesn't it? And no, motive is not something the prosecutor has to prove, but juries love to hear the motive, all right? So let's hear a little bit about this custody battle. So the detective will get that out of the defendant, in this case, Tiffany Adams. Yes, she had a custody battle going back 5 years with Sharon Butler. And it was extremely contentious. And you don't like Sharon, do you? And you know, get her to say that I despise her or whatever. Whoa, powerful in a murder case, right? Now, let's get to the crime. Let's get to the crime. You know, we searched your computer and we found out that you bought some burner phones. What was that for? You bought 5 stun guns. You searched on your computer how to get someone out of their house. All of these things are great evidence against the defendant. If she starts to admit, well, I bought the burner phones because, and she admitted to doing the dirty deed. So if we could start getting some of the other evidence for her to admit to it, it just so strengthens this case. Overt acts. We know we spoke about the other night when we spoke about this case, the mens rea and the actus rea. The mens rea is the mental state of mind. What was your mental state of mind in connection with committing this crime? Well, it can either be reckless, intentional, criminally negligent, and knowingly. So we know in this case right away, we have intentional and knowingly. You just check those two boxes because you intentionally caused the death of Sharon Butler and Jillian Kelly, didn't you? And how did you do it? I would, in this confession, she would tell how she killed them, right? And we don't know yet, do we? They haven't released that. The cause of death still has not been released. There was a hammer on the scene. Could it have been blunt trauma? People had said early on in this case it was gunshots, but there's no evidence of that. We haven't heard that. No one has told us the cause of death was from a gunshot. So we have the defendant admit to how she did it. And when that admission, that confession is matched up with the autopsy and the pathologist ruling the cause of death. Tremendously powerful evidence. Tremendously powerful evidence. So this is all in the confession. So this is why a good interviewer, a good interrogator will take his time or her time, you know. Web searches with purchases. We can match that up. Consciousness of guilt. Things you do. Premeditation. And of course, how powerful are the burner phones leading to the location where the bodies were found, the bodies were buried. And then attempts with where the bodies were buried to conceal the bodies, burying them 10 feet down, covering them with concrete, putting hay over them and try to get cows to eat the hay so they're standing on that ground would just make it look like normal ground, not that there was recently a hole dug in the ground. All of these things should be in that confession, that statement. And if all of these things are in that confession, if all of these things are in that statement, how is this defendant, how is Tiffany Adams going to defeat this? How is she going to beat this case? If all of those things are in this confession, if the detective gets her to admit all the things that they have evidence of, then again, it's extremely, extremely powerful piece of evidence. And let's hope that the detectives from the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, who you see this little thumbnail, did an outstanding investigation. And now four defendants awaiting trial. So I have to assume that they did such a great job of all other parts of the investigation. Why wouldn't they do a good job or a great job in the interview interrogation and getting a confession? So if they did that, then these two you see on the screen, Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly, will get justice in their case. And the four defendants in this case will surely be facing the death penalty. Tiffany Michelle Adams, Tad Cullum, Cole Twombly, and Cora Twombly. All of them are eligible for the death penalty because of these dirty deeds that they did. And the great job that law enforcement did on this case in order to get to this point, to get this case to this point. Banfield discussed with two attorneys, Mark Geragos and Sarah Asari, what possible defenses can these suspects expect to put forth? What attorney, what type of defense is each attorney? And we had heard from News Nation, we don't know if this is 100% true, that three out of the four have enough money to hire private attorneys, and one does not, Cora Twombly. And we asked the question, well, how does a husband, Cole Twombly, have money to hire a private attorney, but his wife, Cora, does not? So Tad Cullum apparently is a wealthy man, and so is Tiffany Adams. So they're going to hire the best attorneys. What type of defense are these attorneys going to come back with? Well, let's listen to Banfield and Mark Geragos and Sarah Asari and see what they say.
Sarah Asari, she is a criminal defense attorney and legal analyst for News Nation. Sarah Asari, she is a criminal defense attorney and legal analyst for News Nation. And Mark Geragos, who's a trial attorney and the co-host of the Reasonable Doubt podcast with Adam Carolla. He's seen a trial or two in his time. Welcome to both of you. So as I was weighing all these bad facts for both, all four of these defendants, I thought I need to get someone to get me off the ledge because to me it looks like just a slam dunk period. So let's start here and we're going to start with Grandma Tiffany. And Sarah, I'm going to begin with you. I'm going to list off just again the whole ugly nature of what the police have that we know of. They've got this so-called maybe confession, maybe not, but something that leads them to believe she's responsible for the deaths. The nasty custody dispute that she was in. The fact that the victims were on their way to see her. She canceled it, but then told police she didn't. She gave the police inaccurate information about that gravesite. She bought 3 burner phones. She bought 5 tasers after searching for them all and searched taser pain level, gun shops, prepaid cell phones, and how to get someone out of their house. So with that, counselor, go ahead with your opening statement to this jury.
I mean, did you just encourage her to plead guilty already, Ashley? She is presumed innocent.
Save her life.
She
is presumed innocent. Sarah, honestly, yeah. If I were you defending her, I'd look at her and say, that is an Everest of bad facts. And if you want to save your life, you might do it this way.
It is. It is. And I think that what the prosecution is calling a confession, I mean, Mark can tell you this too. The client sneezes and they go, oh, he confessed. I mean, here under Oklahoma law, they have to have proof of guilt, meaning they have to have substantial evidence that even though these defendants are presumed innocent, that there's a lot of circumstantial evidence pointing to guilt in order to get no bail hold on them. And so it's just the state's way of strengthening their position in that regard. Because trust me, I mean, a confession is an unequivocal admission of guilt. There is nothing vague and cryptic about it, like this, you know, indication of responsibility. What the hell is that? And if it is a confession, you know, I can't tell how many times I've thought I've had a confession, but there are, you know, they're not voluntary. I mean, that's one way to keep it out.
Sometimes.
You know, I spent the whole first 20 minutes describing how law enforcement takes a statement or a confession that will stand up against these attorneys. You see, the first thing that Sarah Asari, the defense attorney, is saying is that the first thing she'll do is attack the confession and say it was taken involuntarily. And how does she do that? It was coerced. They were tricked. They were threatened. They were mistreated. I went in the first 20 minutes of all the ways that law enforcement prevents that from occurring. And let's hope that the investigators that conducted these interviews did follow those, suggestions because they did it on their own, but they were trained well enough to know that this is what defense attorneys are going to try to say.
They're explainable, like you said. So yeah, sometimes, and we don't know what exactly she said. Like I said last night, I want to hear the audio. I don't want the transcript. I want the audio. And then we can talk about how that's explainable in an innocuous way. You mentioned the custody battle. That is bad. I mean, Mark can be the true believer tonight, but that is very bad. There's 5 years of a custody battle. It is motive, even though the prosecution doesn't need motive. You know, this is motive. She's tried one earlier time. I think there's a statement by somebody that she tried to get the victim out of the house to essentially attack her, and it didn't work. So the custody battle
Wait, there's more to that too, Sarah. That little thing was, let's try and get her out of the house and then throw an anvil through her windshield to kill her way back in February.
Right, to make it look like an accident.
Let's put the list back up so you can see. I want you to be able to just look at that list as well, because on that list, Sarah, hit it hard. You bought 5 stun guns and you bought 3 burner phones. The stun guns are found at the gravesite. The burner phones are tracked to the place where they disappeared and the gravesite and the Twombly's house. How do you explain that away?
So all of this stuff, confession, right? Nasty custody dispute. Of course, that's motive. The custody dispute going back 5 years is motive. The victims were on their way to see Tiffany. Powerful, powerful evidence. She gave the police inaccurate information about the gravesite. She bought 3 burner phones and 5 tasers. And the burner phones were tracked to the gravesite. And the 2 of the burner phones were seen inside the house of Cole and Cora Twombly. And of course, the web searches, the taser pain level, gun shops, prepaid cell phones, how to get someone out of their house. So all of those things that I mentioned that the investigators should try in their, in Tiffany's statement to try to get to her to admit to these things and to talk about these things would make the confession that much more powerful.
Right. And I'll let Mark do that. But the fact that she searched for these things, the fact that she searched, see, this is a client that I would refer to Mark. The fact that she searched for these things, I wasn't bothered by that at all. It's the fact that they're overt acts that match up with the searches. You know, it's that she searched the gun shop, she searched the taser pain, and then she bought the stun guns. She searched how to get somebody out of the house. She searched, I don't know, burner phones and went and bought them at Walmart. The problem is that her searches pair up with the overt acts. And so, that's not very good. The confession I'm not worried about. The custody dispute could be explained. The web searches with the purchases are bad. And then, of course, not knowing where the bodies are. We learned that in the Vallow case, similar situation. When you're covering up, it's consciousness of guilt. I'm not sure how she can explain that. If you ask her, she'll say, I didn't know. I didn't have anything to do with it. I didn't know where the bodies were, except she was at the site where they were buried.
Yeah, and our source, she was at the site the day before while her boyfriend, Tad, was asking the landowner, mind if I do some digging down there? You know, no biggie. I'm just going to remove a tree stump. And the next day, you know, the bodies are buried in 12 noon. The skitter's out. But so I'm going to go to you, Mark, and I'm going to get you to just do, because I want you to do Tad Cullum, and I'm going to list out his bad facts in a minute, but just hit up that whole burner phone and stun guns and how a defense attorney is going to explain that away.
I'll do that only if you do that accent about the going and doing the digging again.
I'll do it every day, all day long. Don't test me. I lived in Texas for 5 years. I can slang with the rest of them.
So the burner phones, generally, one of the things that you say is, look, what you call a burner phone, what the prosecution calls a burner phone, is a prepaid phone. Sometimes people cannot afford to get a dedicated cell phone or any other kind of credit, so they buy prepaid phones. That the prosecution always calls those burner phones. The searches are interesting because I've had cases where there were searches, but it depends on when the searches were. If the searches were prior to the going missing, those are bad facts. If the searches are during the period of time when somebody's missing, that can be explained away. The interesting thing, when you have this many suspects and supposedly admitting responsibility, is what I would be looking for is who's going to cut the first deal, because they're going to want one of these four to roll on the other three. That's a tried and true prosecution tactic, and that's probably what I would imagine is going to end up happening. My father used to always say, first one in the door gets the best deal.
Thank you for watching.
Well, that's not just Mark Garagos's father. We used to say that in the NYPD all the time. You know, we'd have two defendants or three defendants. They'd be in different rooms being interviewed, being interrogated. And we would tell them that their buddy's flipping right now. And whoever flips first gets the best deal. So that's not just a Mark Garagos expression. That was a tried and true expression or known tactic by the prosecution, by the police. Folks, this is Police Off the Cuff. Real crime stories. You like real crime, true crime from a police perspective, then you're in the right place. And if you're not subscribed to us, go on our YouTube, hit that subscribe button, give us a thumbs up, hit that like button, share us with your friends and your family. It's free to subscribe. So as I said, go on YouTube. If you want to contribute to us financially, we have a Patreon with three different levels, and we also have a YouTube channel membership with, count them, five different levels. This case is so, so interesting in that it's, anytime it involves a custody dispute, there's family, there's young woman involved that was the mother of these children. And it has the interest of everyone when we look at these two women. And you know, when we look at Jillian Kelly, who really had no axe to grind here. She was the escort hired by the courts to make sure things went well in the custody dispute when the exchange of the children was going to take place. And don't forget, there was a woman named Bruin, who was the person that Tiffany Adams, was her person that she wanted to be involved in being the escort for Veronica in the exchange of the children. However, she told her to take a week or two off, because obviously she knew what she was going to do. She knew what was going to happen. And she didn't want to kill her, but she was perfectly willing to kill Jillian Kelly, which is really a disgusting fact here, you know, that she was willing to use herself and these other three people to take the life of Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly, but she wasn't willing to kill Miss Bruin, you know. And again, that shows, as my partner Mike Geary would say, consciousness of guilt, premeditation. And when we look at the document in regards to the refusal of bail, we take a really good look at this. Bruin, OSBI interviewed Bruin. That's the woman that Tiffany Adams wanted to be the visitor, the escort, if you will, in the exchange of the children. So SBI interviewed Bruin, and she said she was available to supervise the visit that day, but Adams told her to take a couple of weeks off from the visitation so Adams could question the children related to how Butler's approved visitation supervisors were. Again, premeditation, consciousness of guilt. Butler and Kelly's phone records indicated their devices were actively sending signals to their carriers until approximately 09:42 hours on the day they disappeared, after which the devices were no longer seen by the networks and stopped transmitting. Neither phone was found at the scene or within the vehicle, and they are currently missing. Adams was the last known person to communicate with Butler and was scheduled to meet Butler and Kelly for visitation at 1000 hours on March 30th, 2024. Through the child custody case, recordings were obtained where Rickman, that's the son and the baby's daddy here, the son of Tiffany Adams, discussed death threats by Adams and Adams' boyfriend, Tad Cullum. The custody battle began in February of 2019 with many hearings and court appearances. On March 18th, 2024 and March 20, 2024, motions were filed requesting extended visitation for Butler. A hearing was scheduled to occur on April 17th. Butler's attorney informed OSBI that Butler was likely to receive unsupervised visitation with her children at that hearing. At times, Adams refused to let Rickman have his children, even though Rickman had legal custody of them. Law enforcement previously responded to a call for service where Adams refused to give Rickman his children. Reportedly, the officer told Rickman he believed the children were better off in Adams' care. You know, that's the officer had no right to do that. That's a violation of a court order. You have no right as a sworn law enforcement officer to go against the court order. So I don't know how the officer was able to do that. Muggsy Siegel, it became a YouTube member. Welcome to the family, Muggsy Siegel. Thank you so much for joining. Sana Elise South Johnson, thank you so much for the and Muggsy Siegel, thank you for the $2 super sticker. And Sana Elise Hoth Johnson, thank you so much for your contribution. And OK19, I'll put it on the screen. Appreciate the contribution. Appreciate all you guys our friends, our family, our subscribers, our fans, whatever you want to call you guys, we really appreciate you. Garo Rodriguez, 46, the SA has been unfounded. That were the allegations in this. And, you know, that's the dirtiest in a child custody battle. If those things aren't true, that is the dirtiest thing you could ever accuse someone of, you know? Sherry Murray, Sarge, it seems like this character Adams was used to being in control in a small village and a lot of people who were afraid of her, and this was what she resorted to. Shaking my head. You're 100% right. She seemed to have a lot of power in that community. Her and her boyfriend, Tad Cullum, people in that community seemed to fear them for whatever reason. Here he is on the screen. That's Tad on the screen. And people, again, in that community feared this man. And he and Tiffany Adams threatened her son that they would kill him. So this was, this goes back. And that's why the confession and all the things we hear about in this case, the confession, the evidence, is so important, because we have these overt acts that the confession makes so much more believable when someone admits to it. I'm going to cut down a little bit. On April 1st, 2024, OSBI agents obtained a search warrant for Adams' cellular phone. OSBI agents performed an extraction on the device. Information gained from the device, including web searches for taser pain level, gun shops, prepaid cellular phones, and how to get someone out of their house. We discussed this earlier, and remember I spoke about how all of those things should have been included in the confession. And how do we include it? Well, we ask Tiffany Adams, did you do this? Why did you do this? How did you do this? When did you do this? And all that's documented and hopefully on videotape, not just audio. Audio is it allows a defense attorney to say, oh, my client was being abused, but videotape? You see what you see is what you get pretty much. And you can see the stress level and all of those things. And even this defense attorney, Sarah Asari, was saying, oh, I'm not worried about the confession. Well, you're not worried about a poor confession taken by an investigator that's not good at it. But you will be worried about a confession that's taken by a consummate professional that crosses his T's and dots his I's, because that confession is going to put your client in prison for the rest of her life or get her the death penalty in this case. Pessa from the chat, Veronica's not showing up with the kids to the party is a massive red flag that was drawn up quickly. Then the family found the car with the bloody scene. The suspects didn't plan for that. Pessa, you're so correct. You are so absolutely correct. Todd, who dat Clement? QQ, how could the dad get more visitation reported than he is in rehab? Todd, this was prior to him being in rehab. He was given custody, but then he was in rehab. So how could he have custody? But the court, the family court, gave him custody. Pauline Buckles, Bill always knows what he's talking about. Police off the cuff, the best. Thank you so much, Pauline. I'm going to go back to the bail application here, or them not getting bail application. And one of the most important things in this case, of course, was the 16-year-old eyewitness who was Cora Twombly's daughter. And you could say Cole Twombly is her stepfather, because apparently she has a different biological father. And she can be considered one of the most important cogs in the wheel of this case. On April 3rd, 2024, OSBI interviewed a complainant witness of age 16 years old. Complainant witness is the daughter of Cora Quambly, and Coby White. Coors married to Cole Twombly. Complainant witness stated that she overheard a group conversations related to Butler not protecting her children from her brother, all in reference to a SA allegation. The complainant witness advised that she was told by Cora that Adams, Cullum, Cora, Cole, and Paul Grice were involved in the deaths of Butler and Kelly. She stated that Adams provided burner phones to use so they could communicate without using their personal devices. Complainant witness saw two burner phones charging on Cora's nightstand in her bedroom. Is that powerful evidence that the complainant witness saw two burner phones that she didn't recognize as being the everyday cell phones of Cora and Cole as the two of the burner phones? Because let's not forget, there were three burner phones purchased by Tiffany Adams. There was two of them. Complainant witness, put this back on. Complainant witness described Cora, Cole, Adams, Cullum, Paul Grice as being part of an anti-government group that had a religious affiliation. Through the OSBI investigation, it was learned that they called the group God's Misfits. Regular meetings were held at Twombly's and the home of Barrett and Lacey Cook. And Barrett and Lacey Cook were the two people who were taking care of the children while Tiffany was planning all these dirty deeds. The complainant witness was told on March 29th, 2024, that Cora and Cole would not be home in the morning when she woke and were going to go be on a mission. When the complainant witness awoke at approximately 1000 hours, Cora and Cole were not home but returned home later. Complainant witness knew that Cole and Cora took a blue and gray Chevrolet pickup owned by them and a blue flatbed pickup owned by Clint Twombly when they left and returned in the same vehicles. Complainant witness was told to clean the interior of the Chevrolet pickup. Complainant witness asked Cora what had happened, was told that the things did not go as planned, but that they would not have to worry about her butler again. Complainant witness asked about Kelly and why she had to die, and was told by Cora that she wasn't innocent either, as she had supported Butler. Complainant witness asked Cora if their bodies were put in a well, and Cora replied something like that. And the complainant witness also disclosed that other attempts to kill Butler occurred during February of 2024 near Yucatan, Kansas, in which Adams, Cullum, Cole, Cora, and Grice went to Yucatan, but Butler did not leave her residence. This is consistent with the web search discovered on Adams' phone about how to get someone out of their house. So all of these things are such powerful evidence. And the reason I'm rereading, because I read these on a previous show, was to show that all of these things, all of this evidence they have, documented evidence, somehow should have appeared in the confession. She should have been asked about it in the confession and spoke and get her to admit it in the confession. And whether she did that or not, we don't know. But it should have been asked about in the confession. And let me play this from News Nation here.
Gators, the new details tonight in the case of the killings of two Kansas moms. Tiffany Adams, the prime suspect in the murders of Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly, gave a recorded statement after she was arrested. Investigators say Butler was locked in a custody battle with Adams, her children's grandmother. She is now one of the four suspects now charged with murder and kidnapping. News Nation correspondent Caitlin Becker has been poring through these documents and walks us through what she has learned.
Well, Natasha, investigators are firming up their case against the four individuals accused in the murders of the two Kansas moms who went missing March 30th. We're learning now that one of the suspects, Tiffany Adams, allegedly confessed to law enforcement that she was responsible for the killings. 2 weeks after their car was found abandoned on a rural road in Oklahoma, the bodies of 27-year-old Veronica Butler and 39-year-old Jillian Kelly were discovered in a cow pasture owned by Adams' boyfriend, Tad Cullum. Adams and Cullum were are arrested along with two others, and those four are facing charges of first-degree murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy for these slayings. Now, prosecutors say in new court documents that they have no question about Adams's guilt, pointing out, quote, after arrest, this defendant, Tiffany Adams, did provide a recorded statement to law enforcement indicating her responsibility for the death of the deceased. Now, the state didn't go into detail about how far Adams's alleged involvement in the murders went, but according to an affidavit from investigators, she was the last person to communicate with Veronica Butler, and the victims had been scheduled to meet up with Adams the day they vanished. Now, the women were supposed to pick up Butler's children from Tiffany Adams, who is their paternal grandmother, and they were going to have a supervised visit. Now, at the heart of this case is what law enforcement describes as a problematic custody battle between Veronica Butler and Tiffany Adams over the children that she shares with Adams' son. Now, in April, there was supposed to be a hearing that could have tipped custody in favor of Butler. And that is what authorities believe, Natasha, motivated the four suspects to murder.
Caitlin, with that, thank you. And here now to provide more insight, News Nation legal analyst and criminal trial attorney Sarah Azari. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us. And I know you've also been poring through these new court documents. What is standing out to you?
Yeah, so Natasha, look, I'm not shaking in my boots over this indication of responsibility that is being looked at as a confession. I can't tell you how many times prosecutors jump up and down and scream that they have a confession. And then when you actually not just look, read the words on a piece of paper like a transcript, but listen to the audio, it is really not a confession. So really it depends on what she said, what the context is, what the tone is. All of it needs to be considered. But that said, Natasha, I think this affidavit that was filed along with the bail motion by the state is really damning. It is very robust. It lays out the circumstantial evidence in this case, namely lies by Adams. And we know that where there's lies, there's cover up. Web searches that maybe by themselves are benign and innocuous, but she followed up on them. So for example, search of taser pain level. And then she went and bought five stun guns, and there were stun guns found near the bodies. Burner phones. There were three burner phones that she actually purchased from Walmart that were again traced to the locations that are at issue. And then two star witnesses. Those really stood out to me, Natasha, because there is the daughter of Cora, one of the suspects, who essentially says that her parents went on a mission the day that these victims were missing and that they came back and made some incriminating statements to her. She is a star witness, and so is the property owner from whom Adams's boyfriend rents the property where the bodies were found. There's some very incriminating statements that were made to him. So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence, even if there is no confession.
Interesting. I mean, and let's zero in on the confession itself, because it seems on its face that Tiffany made a recorded confession. Can she go back on this? I mean, you say this is not a slam dunk for the case moving forward.
Yeah, it definitely isn't. You know, if there's, we got to listen to what she says, because this is obviously an audio, not just a manually written out statement. And we got to look at the context. And sometimes confessions are forced and coerced. Sometimes they just have a completely innocuous explanation. Again, you know, we have to listen to what she said and be able to determine whether this is just the prosecution's interpretation that it's a confession or if it's a really unequivocal confession.
Well, you know, as I had spent the whole first 20 minutes of this case talking about, a professional detective, interviewer, interrogator, make sure that he does it correctly. And as I said, this shouldn't have been audio recorded. This should have been video recorded, video and audio, because this way, when you get an attorney like Sarah Azari, who is a talking head, of course, on News Nation, and she starts saying that the confession could have been coerced, it could have been forced, it could have been created, it could have been basically, you know, using all these disparaging sort of allegations against the police. Well, you know, that didn't really happen when you get really good investigators that know their job. And it, to me, if Tiffany Adams was going to confess, let's get our best guy in there. Let's make sure we have the videotape. This is a double murder. It's a death penalty case. if she's going to confess, we're not going to do a schlocky job. We're going to have the very best interviewer, the very best interrogator interview this lady, because four individuals are under arrest for this. And does she wants to take, she wants to take the biggest hit. She wants to take responsibility. She wants to confess as performing the overt act that caused the death of Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly. She wants to tell us how she did it, the cause of death, which is we still don't know. So if she says in her confession that she beat both of them to death with a hammer and they have wounds that match that, then I would say that's a pretty damn good confession. I don't care what the attorney says. If she matches up in her confession with the way Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly were killed, then I would say that that's a pretty damn good confession. And I have a hard time when defense attorneys start saying, oh, it was coerced, it was invented, they were forced, they were beaten, they were not given food, they were not given water. You know, I certainly didn't see that on the NYPD. Could that happen in other places? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
10 o'clock. Did this grandmother admit to killing two women in the Oklahoma Panhandle? New tonight, we're getting a look at what she told investigators. I'm Abigail Ogle.
I'm Jessica Schambach. Prosecutors say Tiffany Adams, the prime suspect in the murders of Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly, gave a recorded statement after she was arrested. KOCO's Jason Berger got a hold of those documents and is live now. So, Jason, walk us through what you learned.
Yeah, guys, this is a motion to hold Adams without bail, and it says she told investigators she was responsible for the deaths of Veronica and Jillian.
I'm just glad that the people that need to be caught got caught.
Locals from Guymon and surrounding towns showed up to the Texas County Courthouse this week when Tiffany Adams and three other suspects were brought in for their first hearing. That same day, these court documents were filed. Prosecutors stated proof of Adams' guilt is evident, saying, quote, the state would point out that after arrest, this defendant, Tiffany Adams, did provide a recorded statement to law enforcement indicating her responsibility for the death of the deceased.
They've destroyed so many lives.
Not just their own.
Not just their own, but everybody else. They've destroyed the kids. They're without their mothers now. It's sad.
Prosecutors also allege Adams and her co-conspirators weren't afraid to target a judge. The documents say, quote, there are statements of the co-conspirators that their problem would be taken care of because, in addition to removing Veronica, they knew the path the judge walked to work. The documents also say there were multiple other attempts to murder Butler in Oklahoma and Kansas.
To support and show up for court hearings and make sure, you know, we're heard and that justice needs to be served.
Now, the documents also say Adams and her boyfriend, Tad Cullum, had a violent history, including, quote, death threats and intimidation against individuals who disagree with their ideas. In Oklahoma City, Jason Berger, KOCO, 5 News.
So, you know, that other thing about them threatening to kill the judge, or that they knew the path that the judge walked to court or to home, that's pretty damning, too. It just shows that their willingness to use violence to get the results that they wanted in their life in this case, just really absolutely ridiculous. And, you know, News Nation has covered this case since the very beginning, and I think they've done an outstanding job. And so many factors, there's so much evidence in this case. Besides the physical evidence, I talked about the mens rea, the mental states of mind, and the actus rea, which is the overt act. And all of these things put them, as Phil Grimaldi would say, in the trick bag. And they have a tremendous amount of evidence against these people. And it's no small thing that they recovered the bodies, because in a homicide case, the body itself is a crime scene. And now they recover them based on the burner phones, putting them at the location. They discover that they're buried 10 feet below the ground. They discovered attempts were made to conceal the hole. Hay being put, cement being put over it, cows being put to eat the hay so that they would trounce on the ground and they wouldn't be able to tell. So a lot of thought went into this, which is called premeditation.
The two Kansas women who fell victim to an elaborate murder plot in Oklahoma weren't meant to be found for decades, if ever. That's according to the court documents filed by investigators. They say Tad Cullum, boyfriend of Grandma Tiffany Adams, buried the women's bodies in a 10-foot hole in a pasture that he was renting from a man named Michael Beasley. 2 days before the women disappeared, Tad allegedly asked his landlord if he could use a skid steer to remove a stump and bury some concrete and do some dirt work on the land near a dam. And the landowner said, yeah, sure, that's fine. But the day after the women disappeared, Tad allegedly told the landlord, now there might be a problem. He said the police were looking at him, Tad, as a possible suspect, and that the skid steer might, you know, the tracks might look suspicious, to which the landlord responded that if anyone asked, he would say what he knew, that Tad had been out doing some work, dirt work. News Nation's senior national correspondent Brian Enten got exclusive access to the property, and there was dirt work, all right. A massive 10-foot grave had been dug and filled back in within hours. Here's what Brian saw on the night that he went out.
It's dark out here, so bear with me, but this is the area where the missing women were found. This is the spot. You remember in the police report, they mentioned a dam. This right here, this buildup of dirt, this is the dam. There's a pond on the other side. And if you walk with me this way, just about 50 feet or so, maybe a little more from the dam, you can see where the earth is disturbed, where the tractors were out here. This is where investigators came. They dug right in this area, went down about 10 feet, I'm told. And this is where they discovered the missing mom's bodies. If you look in the distance there, you can see there is a pile of hay back there. I am told by sources that hay was moved over the area where the digging happened, that Tad, the suspect Tad, moved that hay over here to cover up the area where he was digging, hoping that the cows, this is a, you know, there's a cow farm here, that the cows would come over, this is a ranch, and start feeding on the hay and make the area look less suspicious. But still, investigators were led to this spot. And again, this is the area right here where they started digging and they found the bodies.
Just incredible work by Brian Enten. I misspoke. It was not Michael Beasley. The landowner's Jamie Beasley. And again, he leased the land to Tad Cullum. And Tad Cullum asked the landlord, mind if I just do some dirt work down there?
Thank you for watching.
So pretty amazing how all of the things in this case come together. And all the important things they've discovered, where the bodies were buried, where they were dug, covering them with cement, covering them, digging 10 feet down, covering them with hay, finding out they were going to have some cows walk over the hay so that it could make the ground look like it wasn't recently dug up. All what we would call premeditation. Unbelievable, right? So all of this stuff, Patrick Orion, you can get implements from skid steers like backhoe attachment forks, etc. There's all kinds of attachments for skid steers. I'm not sure what the point was there. So they absolutely tried to cover up the field so that it wouldn't be evident that the ground was disturbed and that was where the bodies were burned. But the phone work, the cell phone work, the geofencing that put the phones within like 20 feet of where the bodies were buried is like, that evidence is so incredible. It's so unbelievably incredible. And I'm going to go to the day that all the suspects went to court. And again, this was Brian Enten on that day and interviewing some of the family members of the victims. That shows just how tragic a case this actually is.
To
have our cameras or phones inside the courthouse. I want you to look at this video. You can see all of the suspects being brought out of the courthouse and put into police cars one by one and taken back to the jail. Bond was denied for all four suspects. And they all but one said that they had the money to afford a private attorney, but none of them had found an attorney at this point. It was very, very emotional, Marnie. I don't think I've ever been in a court hearing quite like it, because it was a very, very small courtroom, and you had the victim's family members take up three of the rows of the courtroom. And some of them actually had to be physically held back during the hearing. They were sobbing and trying to lunge at the suspects as they were brought in, and other family members had to hold them back. And then they were actually saying things to the suspects during the hearing. They weren't actually shouting, but I mean, you could hear exactly what they were saying. They called Grandma Tiffany Adams, who of course is believed to be the orchestrator of these murders. They called her an effing bee. They called the other man a bastard, and a lot of expletives, a sorry ass piece of S word, which was just interesting to hear in a courtroom as the defendants were brought in. Obviously, they're very, very emotional about what happened. I would say about maybe two dozen family members inside the courtroom as the hearing went on. But again, the headline here, bond denied, and they will be back in court sometime next month, Marnie.
You talk about an emotionally charged situation. I feel for those families to be in that courtroom, see these people for the first time. Again, just drawing folks' attention to the screen. This is the first time we are seeing these four suspects publicly as they walk into court. Brian, how did the judge handle that interaction between the suspects and these family members?
Let me just quickly, Marnie, because court just ended, and this is... I'm sorry. Do you mind if we talk to you real quick, ma'am? You're Veronica's aunt, right?
I'm sorry.
Are you Veronica's aunt?
I am.
That's one of the victims. I'm so sorry. I was just telling Marnie, our anchor. First of all, I'm so sorry for everything you've been through. And just that courtroom was so small. I can't imagine. You guys were just so close to them. I mean, what was that like?
You know, to hold my brother back from jumping, you know, there's just too many emotions, so much anger. I don't understand how somebody can hate somebody so much that you want to kill him. My niece did not deserve that. Neither did the young lady with her. She was just there to help her. We didn't deserve this. Our family didn't deserve this.
Yeah, and they were just emotionless, the defendants, when they were brought in. I mean, yeah. Did you know them before this?
No, we don't know them personally. No.
It's okay.
We're good. Yeah, thank you so much, ma'am. Thank you. Yeah, as you can see, Marnie, I mean, again, I've never really experienced anything quite like it, because it was such a small courtroom, and you had family members having to hold back other family members trying to actually go after the suspects, which, in light of everything they're going through and having to be so close to these people accused of such heinous crimes, you know, you can't really blame them. You can kind of understand just how raw the emotion was.
I think each and every one of us sympathizes with what they're going through and the nightmare that they're living. Brian, what's next now that this hearing has taken place? What's the next step in the court case?
So there will be a hearing on May 15th. That is when they will have a status hearing, and several of the suspects will appear with their new lawyers that they will be hiring. And remember, many of these suspects, Tad and Grandma Tiffany in particular, these are wealthy people from what we can tell. They own a lot of land. They have a lot of influence in this community. They have a lot of business connections. So we would presume they're going to get, you know, high dollar defense attorneys to represent them, because, you know, they clearly have the resources.
I'm wondering, Brian, as in a lot of these hearings, it's early on, right? Bond is set, not guilty pleas are usually entered. Any evidence provided? Is there anything new we learned about the evidence prosecutors had that led to their arrest today?
Not really in particular. What happened is they brought each suspect in one by one. So they kind of went through the same process four times and read the charges. There weren't any new details that we didn't already know from the police reports. But the main point was just to read them their charges, to see if they were going to hire a private attorney. And really, again, what I walk away just thinking about is just seeing all those family members. And that was just really quite a moment, just the raw emotion.
Thank you for watching.
So, you know, that was when they were in court. We all know the charges were read. We know what the charges are. We still don't know one of the most important things. And we still don't know the cause of death. Important. The autopsy results have not been released. And, you know, we'll keep following this case to give you that information once we do have it. Folks, if you're looking for a good attorney in the New York metropolitan area, then Joe Murray is your man. Joe's a retired NYPD police officer and a fantastic defense attorney. You can reach Joe on his cell phone at 718-514-3855. Email him at joe@jmurray-law.com. Go on his website, joe@jmurray-law.com. Not only is Joe a fantastic defense attorney, but a huge supporter of the Police Off the Cuff podcast. And we appreciate his support and everything he's done for the show over the years. So basically what the whole sort of my dissertation here was, if you will, was what type of defenses were these defendants going to come up with? And one of the things that Attorney Geragos, who's a famous attorney, he says that he thinks, and we suggested this early on in the case, is that one of these defendants is going to be cut a deal. And what will that deal? It won't be a walk away deal. It may be a deal that just saves the person's life. Yeah, you could do life in prison if you testify rather than get the death penalty. That's always used as a bargaining chip in these type of cases. We always want to remember Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly. They are the two victims in this case. And we pray for them and their families for this horrible crime, this horrible loss. Folks, I want to thank everyone for tuning in today. Olivia Robinson, my question is, how are they going to build a jury from people out here that don't know these people? I live in Texas County. I don't know them, but I know a lot of people who do know them. Well, Olivia, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Could they change venue? Yeah, absolutely. Will that happen? I don't know. We'll have to see. We'll have to wait and see. Randall Hine, Bill's a savvy 27-year NYPD veteran. Thank you so much, Randall. Kim Princess, Pessa, I was just thinking the same thing. You guys are talking to each other in the chat. Very good. Yeah, I mean, this case is we're just early on in it. So there's a lot of questions that aren't answered right now. Mama Bear, yes, so true. Read the judge letting the families express themselves. That was an act of humanity in a case where the women were treated so inhumanely. You're right. That's a good experience, savvy judge. Folks, again, thank you so much for tuning in today. I'm Bill Cannon from Police Off the Cuff, Real Crime Stories. We'll keep up with this case, and as new information comes out, we'll do another episode. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great day, and God bless. One episode, just ain't enough.